session number 12571, Rule 2.
Admiral Hazlitt, Rule 2.
At Fort Blockhouse, which I think was first built as a fortress in the 14th century, I must be one of the very few people who's been in action from it. I then went from Fort Blockhouse up to the Clyde, where a depot ship and the 7th submarine flotilla had been established, with all the old submarines in which we were to get more practice in attacking. I did about 15 attacks in elderly submarines on mostly very unsuitable targets, such as trawlers and small auxiliary vessels. And the biggest attack I did was on the Cyclops, the depot ship which came to sea, screened by two submarines, actually. This was the sort of most advanced attack I did. And I was then declared as qualified as a submarine CO.
Did you feel that the preparation you'd had was adequate?
Not at all, but it was the best that could be provided. I then went to an H-class submarine, was appointed in command of an H-class submarine completing refit at Sheerness, and brought her around the north of Scotland to do training duties, mainly for Western Approaches escort vessels to practice their ASDICs on. And during my 3 months in her, I managed to double the number of attacks. I always got the escorts to give me an attack at the end. The most advanced one I did was on an ex-American four-funnel destroyer, which gave me a fairly fast attack in which I actually fired dummy torpedoes. And after those 15 attacks, added to the ones I'd done before, yes, I felt fairly happy.
When did you go off on your own operations?
Well, after the 3 months in the H-44, this was, I was appointed to Malta, to the Mediterranean. And
In H-44?
No, as a spare CO, as a spare submarine captain. I was told to join the Cachalot at Plymouth, a submarine. The only way to get to Malta in those days was by submarine or aircraft, and the Cachalot was on her way to Malta.
Which month are we in now?
I would guess we've got to April or May 41. And we made the passage to the Mediterranean. I remember arriving at Plymouth at the Southern Railway station the day after a very heavy air raid on the whole of the 4th Street area of Devonport. And when I left the railway station, the whole town was in ruins. It looked like pictures of Ypres in the First World War. It really was devastated. And I managed to get a taxi, quite how, I don't know, down to the dockyard, where I found the Cachalot and joined her and was informed that there was no bunk for me, but they cleared out a lot of books from a cupboard and I could sleep in there. It was a sort of fairly long cupboard, fortunately, but I couldn't stretch out my feet full, and so I used to sleep in this cupboard. That night in Plymouth, there was an extremely heavy air raid. The armament depot was hit, the oil tanks were blazing, and it really was quite a night. And when we set sail next morning into the Bay of Biscay, one felt quite relieved.
Are there any more details you can give me about the blitzing of Plymouth and Devonport?
Well, I only saw it that one night, but it was pretty devastating. I mean, the damage done before I got there was appalling. I spent that night in a landing ship, which was a cross-channel steamer, which had plenty of accommodation. And they'd arranged that I'd sleep that night, as we weren't sailing till the morning, in the cross-channel steamer. But it was there wasn't any sleep. It was at action stations with hoses playing on the decks, and all this sort of thing, and fire watchers everywhere, and a very heavy raid indeed. I remember the armament depot at Bull Point being in a state, and the oil tanks blazing especially. The South Yard, where we were alongside, was not hit that night. Then we set off for the Mediterranean. We went a fairly comfortable trip to Gibraltar. And then we moved on east from Gibraltar and arrived at Malta, where we found much the same thing going on as we had left behind at Plymouth. Very heavy air raids in progress. Just after the Illustrious had been heavily bombed in Malta. She had actually left Malta by the time I got there. And there I took up my position as spare submarine captain to the flotilla in Malta. The spare submarine captain's duty was, he was the harbour master. He administered the spare crew, which was always being called on to provide people in place of people who'd gone sick in submarines and things like that. He used to meet every submarine when it came in, like a harbour master, so to speak. And I always remember the submarine captains, as they came in, they used to see you there, hoping to see them looking ill and needing relief. And they always used to say, "I'm feeling quite all right, thank you." And so you had to go on being a spare CO for a bit longer. Eventually, in midsummer, it was considered that the operational submarine captains were really getting very tired. And I was sent out in the Upholder, Lieutenant Commander Wanklin's boat, for one patrol while he was rested. We were sent to a position in the middle of the Ionian Sea where the route from Messina to Benghazi crossed that from Taranto to Tripoli. And this intersection point was thought worth investigating, but in fact we saw nothing except a hospital ship going by, and so I had a blank patrol.
That was the summer of
41. Very shortly after that, I was to take out another submarine, the Unique, to give Lieutenant Commander Collett a rest. And that was a very, very different patrol. We were sent south to Tripoli, where I now know that we were reading the enemy ciphers and that they'd had a report that this troop convoy was leaving Naples, going round the west end of Sicily, to Tripoli. There were two submarines off Tripoli already, the P-32 and the P-33, and I was sent to join them. Another two submarines were sent out to the Lampedusa-Lampion area to intercept earlier. I joined the Unique. My only experience of a U-class submarine was this one patrol in Upholder that I had done. We went out allegedly for an exercise period with Lieutenant Commander Collett. I did a dummy attack on the trawler which we went out with, and then he went back in the trawler and I pressed on for Tripoli. Tripoli was only one night away in those days. If you went at a good speed all night, you were there in the morning. And I approached with some caution, though the coastline was extremely low there, and you didn't want to run into it, and navigation wasn't easy. Soundings gave an indication of the approach of the coast, but you didn't like using your sounding machine any more than necessary because it made a noise. However, I managed to get down there into position. I called the other two submarines and I got P-32 and talked to him by ASDIX. But I never got P-33. We now know that P-33 had hit a mine and was already sunk. The next day, I think it was the next day, I may be wrong in my chronology here, but it could easily be verified from the patrol reports. I watched very carefully and saw the minesweepers come out of Tripoli. I could just see the high buildings in Tripoli on the horizon, so I was about 10 miles northwest of Tripoli. I saw the minesweepers come out, and they very obligingly showed me where the channel was. So I took up my position. Then a torpedo boat came out to meet this convoy. And, of course, I was getting air reports of this convoy as it approached, and I was expecting to sight it any moment. And I was able to get into position just off the swept channel. And sure enough, into sight came this important troop convoy. It consisted of four liners, the Neptunia, Oceania, Marco Polo, and Hesperia. And they were in a square formation. They had six fleet destroyers zigzagging as a screen. They were led in by this torpedo boat that went out to meet them. They also had two motor torpedo boat things, one on each side, and three seaplanes. The sea was nice and disturbed by a force four or five wind, which was knocking up white horses, which is just what you want to make it difficult for your periscope to be seen. And it all happened very quickly. They were going something like 80 knots, this outfit. And they came past. I was inside the screen, or these destroyers were sort of zigging over the top of me. I watched them, but paid little attention to them. And got into position to attack. I was almost too close, about 600 yards off track, which you don't want to get any closer than that in case the torpedoes run under. And one of these motor torpedo boat things came absolutely straight for us. I didn't think he had seen us. He was simply on the course of the convoy, so we let him go over, and he went right over the front of the submarine. Shallow draft, and I stayed up at periscope depth, because if I'd gone deep, I should have missed the whole lot, you see. Even so, I missed the first ship of the port column, which was the Marco Polo. But I got a very careful shot of four torpedoes at the second ship, the Hesperia. And the torpedoes, incidentally, were old Mark IVs of the First World War vintage. They were destroyer torpedoes converted to submarine use in Malta because of the shortage of torpedoes at the time. And I fired all four spread just over a length apart on the Hesperia. And we had difficulty in holding the submarine down. A small submarine like that, when you fire torpedoes, tends to bounce up to the surface because of the tubes being full of air momentarily. It gives you buoyancy. However, by flooding a Q-tank, which those submarines had, which was forward, a quick-diving tank, we held her. But only just. She just didn't break surface, and then we went down. I was so busy concerned with this and with getting off the tracks, getting away from the tracks, because the only way the Talon destroyers knew where you were in those days were the torpedo tracks, so it was essential to get as far away from them as you could as quickly as possible. We went deep down to about 60, over 60 feet, turned hard to starboard and went full speed submerged for about 2 or 3 minutes to clear the tracks. And during this time, I was so busy in doing this that I didn't even hear the torpedoes hit. But I could tell from the elation of the men in the control room round me that they'd heard the hits, and they were saying, they were all frightfully pleased and saying, three hits. I'd never myself even heard them. We then steadied up, and the ASDIC operator said he could hear breaking up noises and so on, and all the rest of it, and we slowed right down, got into silent routine, and headed north away from the coast. We went on that way for, I suppose, well over an hour, and I then came up to periscope depth and had a look. And having had a look round, and the coast appearing reasonably clear, we reloaded the torpedo tubes, which took the whole ship's company in those days. It took over an hour to do it, and we reloaded the tubes. And I then set a patrol routine of which in the Mediterranean we used to come up, the officer watch used to take a good look round. Then we used to go down to about 50 feet because it was harder for aircraft to see you. And then we used to come up, have another look. And we were doing that routine, I suppose, 2 hours after reloading the torpedoes, when the officer of the watch, who was a sub-lieutenant, came to my bunk where I was asleep and said, there's a flying boat in the vicinity. And fortunately, I went out to look. I put the periscope up, and this officer of the watch, who was not a very experienced person, thought the flying boat was a long way away. It wasn't. It was jolly close. And it was turning, banking in, and had obviously seen us. And so I went deep at once, as fast as we could. And there was a very heavy explosion at very shortly afterwards of the bomb, followed by another much heavier one, which put out lights and did quite a lot of minor damage. And we went deep and stayed deep until it was dark. When I came up after dark to surface, there was a very strong smell of oil fuel. And then I looked astern, and we were leaving a trail of oil fuel, and this bomb had clearly ruptured a fuel tank. So I made a radio signal to Malta saying, I've got a bad fuel leak, I'm coming home, and made straight for Malta.
Was this an enemy flying boat?
This was an Italian Cant flying boat, C-A-N-T, I think they were only two-seaters. They were quite small flying boats. I arrived at Malta next morning when nothing I could do would make this damn tank leak. And I met my Commander Simpson, who was the in command at Malta, and I said, I can't make the damn thing leak, but I assure you it was leaking like anything yesterday. And he said, well, don't worry, we're very pleased to see you. Both P-32 and P-33 were lost, so we were the only survivor of that patrol line. P-32 actually hit a mine while trying to attack the same convoy just after I'd attacked it. So there were mines about. I suppose we were just plain lucky, I don't know. I then turned the boat back to Lieutenant Commander Collett and resumed my duties as spare CO. And if you...
Yes, I was thinking when you said that you could see from the positions of the minesweepers where the swept channel was, that it's not easy to memorize the exact point in the sea where they were.
Well, you could approach Tripoli from the northwest on a number of courses. And of course, to be told exactly where the enemy is going to pass is very valuable. Very valuable.
What happened to you next?
Well, I went back to being spare CO for not very long, and I was then appointed permanently in command of a submarine called the Ursula, whose captain went sick. I did about three or four patrols in the Ursula, none of which were particularly distinguished, except that I was one of the four submarines in the attack in September 1941 on the troop convoy from Taranto to Tripoli, in which the upholder sank both the Oceania and the Neptunia. The third ship of the convoy, the Vulcania, came on and passed me close to the Tripoli coast after the other two had been sunk. And I took a shot at her, but it was long range, and I unfortunately missed. The only other attack which is worth mentioning was one in which a convoy was coming round the west of Sicily for Tripoli, and which we had information about through our reading the enemy's ciphers. I was sent out from Malta to intercept. And we went out in daylight with a fighter escort of two fighters, if I remember rightly, circling round us. And we set a course from the south coast of Malta to intercept. We ran all night on that course as fast as we could. We dived as soon as it got light. Shortly afterwards, we sighted the mastheads of the convoy. We were clearly a long way off track, so we did two long bursts of speed submerged to close in, and we just got in a shot at maximum range and hit, but didn't sink. It just damaged a ship called the Beppe, which was a ship with heavy derricks that used to carry tanks. What is of interest about this attack is that we set the course on leaving Malta and we never altered it during the whole time. We fired the torpedoes on the same course as we'd left Malta.
When was this?
I would say October 41. Might have been November. We did one or two other fairly inconspicuous patrols in which various things happened. And the Ursula was then due for refit, and we left for home at Christmas time, 1941. When we got to Gibraltar, we were sent post-haste up into the bay, where the Scharnhorst and Eisenau were beginning to be look as though they were going to come out. They didn't come out when we expected them to, and I went on up the channel and on to Chatham to refit. As soon as I had got to Chatham, the Scharnhorst and Eisenau made their famous dash up the channel. I was then appointed to command the...
Just before we go, leave that channel breakout, how much fault do you think there was on the part of the submarine service for missing that?
Missing the Scharnhorst and Eisenau?
Yes.
Well, I think if we had had more submarines, in fact, when the Scharnhorst and Eisenau broke out, we had two submarines off Brest. One was, I think, the Sea Lion, which had tried to go into the exercise areas to catch them exercising, but they weren't there, and then had to withdraw to charge, and while she was out charging, they nipped out and up channel. The other submarine was, I think, H-31, or H-34, which was well out from the coast and had no chance of sighting them. I don't think the submarines could have done much more. If there had been more available, I don't think there's any doubt they would have been put on the seaward side of Brest and wouldn't have achieved anything. Catching them going up channel was a business for aircraft, motor torpedo boats, destroyers, and so on of the fleet.
Sorry, I interrupted you with you saying what happened to you after February 42.
Well, I was appointed to the Trident, my old submarine, which I'd been first lieutenant of, to relieve Commander Sladen, who had been my captain there 18 months previously. He had just returned from a patrol in which he torpedoed the Prince Eugen off Trondheim. I took over from him and did one patrol off the Norwegian coast. My only recollection of this is that we were told we were not to fire at anything except the Tirpitz, and I watched 100,000 tons of unescorted shipping pass me without being able to fire at it. It's mainly what I remember about that. We next were sent to Iceland to escort a North Russian convoy to North Russia. This was the famous PQ-16, in which we followed all the way to Russia.